Hey, this is Walt, and we are live with the Indie Creator Spotlight. Joining me is my partner in crime, Mr. Andrew Cullis. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. How you doing, Walt?
Trying to stay out of trouble. And today, we are interviewing comics race car driver, Mr. Vito Del Sante. How are you, sir?
I'd like an explanation on that nickname.
You know, the
Mario Andretti is a very Italian name, I guess. Or
yeah, well, you know, I mean, you know, you're getting in the car and you're driving it like you stole it. So, I mean, you got Stray, you got World War Mob, plenty of projects coming and going now with Action Lab. So, it seems like you started with the pack, but now you're starting to pull away and really making a name for yourself.
I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, you work on the things that you want to work on, and you know you work on them when you can work on them. I don't think that you can. I don't know how much pulling away from the pack I am. I still consider myself lost in the shuffle, just like everybody else that does independently published books. I tend to support more of those than I do mainstream stuff like Marvel and DC, but. I think, you know, it's just me just being where it's more conducive to having a voice, not so much being the loudest voice.
And where did you find that voice? When did you start getting into comics?
As far as reading or writing?
A little bit of both. Well, start with reading. When did you first pick up your first book, and do you remember what it was?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I know that the Batman TV show had something to do with it. So my affinity for that show probably led my dad to getting me a Batman comic. The first comic I bought, though, I do remember, it was an Uncanny X-Men. I want to say it was like 170-something. It was the first Carol Danvers as Binary issue. So it was the third story. It was, I think Dave Cockrum was still on the book or had come to pitch in for the transition between John Byrne and Paul Smith. And Paul Smith is one of my favorite artists of all time. So it was kind of culture shock to see how good. And this is, I don't mean to besmirch Dave Cockrum's legacy, but Paul Smith is just from another planet. Like he doesn't. There's no one that can touch him when he's on his game, you know. So the reason why I bought that book was because I had seen Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and I think the X-Men were on it, where Wolverine's Australian and stuff. So it was pretty awful, you know, in hindsight, pretty awful episode. But I bought it right after seeing, like, the cartoon came on, I think, at around 11 o'clock, maybe even 10:30 on NBC over here. So as soon as it was over, they had the Hulk come on right after. And as soon as that was over, I walked literally around the corner to this soda fountain shop that had like a deli counter, but they had a magazine rack, and the magazine rack had comics. So it was the closest place I could get comics, and that was the first one I got. I knew it was something with X-Men. I wanted Wolverine in the book, which is funny because now you can find Wolverine in just about every book. But yeah, I that was probably the first book I ever bought with my own money.
So for you, introduction to comics was Spinner Rack and not Comic Book Shop.
Yeah, Comic Shop came immediately after because I found out we didn't grow up with much money. So when we would go to the mall, it was a big deal. Now to go to the mall in Staten Island where I grew up, you had to go buy this McDonald's. So at McDonald's that was there, we would go to kind of as a treat, like, you know, like it was a big deal. Oh, we went to the mall and Toys R Us and McDonald's? Like, whoa, what, you know, it must be a birthday or something. So right next to that McDonald's, a place called The Comic Shop, which was run by Lou Manna Jr.'s dad. Lou Manna Jr. does a lot of, inking and stuff currently for, like, Moonstone and whatever. But his dad opened the first comic shop that I had ever seen. Fast forward to 20 years later where I'm working for Jim Hanley, it was huge in the direct market in New York. It's in New York and, you know, globally, really. I, you know, when I was working there, I just remember people saying, wow, this is the store I wanted to see. And I couldn't understand why, and it's because, you know, the direct market grew, and all those retailers kind of, they started, like, in news groups and stuff, and they just would talk to each other, and a lot of the philosophies would be shared amongst all the retailers. So Jim was one of those, you know, major pioneers in the early days with Phil Suling doing the New York shows, and a lot of those guys, like, the direct market sprung out of those New York shows way back when, before there were, like, Wizard shows. And there was, like, a Marvel show back in the 80s that I never knew about, but many years later I found out, and those were the guys that I, you know, like, that guy is the guy that I worked with and worked for. So when I found Jim Hanley's, I remember buying, it was the same year, and I only remember this because I remember seeing it and not picking it up, but it was the same year that Dark Knight Returns got covered in Playboy, and I just remember looking up, it was on the top shelf, I couldn't reach it, and it was a Playboy magazine, and I just thought, wow, Playboy magazine in a comic store, that's weird. But I saw that, you know, Frank Miller's Dark Knight was on it, and on that trip to the store, I bought School is Hell by Matt Groening. So, I mean, like, I was always a Sunday funny guy. I loved Spider-Man in the Phantom and a lot of those original kind of comic strip, you know, pulps, I guess, you know, in a sense. But the first comic store I ever went to, I bought just an X-Men comic, probably, because it was the thing that I was biggest into.
And are you still in New York?
Am I still in New York? Yeah, with a lot of stops in between. I was born here when I was around 11, possibly 12. I think it was 11 going on 12. I moved to Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, which is kind of where I met my wife a couple years later when she was 13 and I was 15. And I went to college at the University of Pittsburgh for a little bit. When I dropped out, I moved back to New York. Then I moved to L.A. a couple years later, 6 years later. Then after L.A., I was in L.A. for 3 months, and I just couldn't do it. And I moved to Seattle for a little over a year. Then I moved back to New York, and I've just been here since. But yeah, I'm a New York guy more than anything.
Nice. Have you ever stopped by Andrew's side of the woods up in Canada?
I've been to Toronto, and I've been to Montreal.
There you go.
And I love Montreal. Like it's funny because I'm working on the director's commentary for issue 4, and I was talking about the main villain, who I won't reveal because he comes out in issue 4 just next month. But the main villain, he speaks French a lot, and I knew that he was Quebecois, and I wanted to make sure that people knew that it's not that I have anything against French Canadians or anything. I literally Montreal is one of the most beautiful cities I've ever seen, and I haven't been very many places, you know, and I fell in love with the churches and the architecture there and stuff. People were always like, did you see the strip clubs? And I'm not really a strip club guy, but the women were beautiful that I, you know, the ones that I saw. It was November, so I didn't really get to see any like warm weather, you know, dresses or anything like that, but it's just a beautiful city. And the thing that I wrote in the commentary was, it's so easy to make him French, you know, or make him from France, and I just wanted to throw something a little bit of, you know, different, kind of like how they made Batroc in the Captain America movie from Algiers instead of from France. I believe, like, in the comics, he was in the French Foreign Legion and stuff, so I can't remember exactly if he was from Paris or where he was from in France, but I know that he was French.
Two things for you. Hang on. I'm gonna save you some embarrassment next time you come to Montreal. English people say Montreal like it has a U, and French say Montreal like it has a long O. Only Americans say Montreal. We can identify you guys immediately when you say the city name and go, oh, you're from the States.
Well, I recognize that the city name is Quebec, not Quebec.
Well, yeah, Quebec, it's K, it's this hard time. Yeah. The other thing is you know Plastique. Remember Plastique from Firestorm?
Yes, yes.
Back in the 80s, she was my favorite villain because she was Quebecois. She was was from Quebec originally, and then that's when she showed up on Flash and she was an American. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Max Poor, man. That doesn't work for me. But anyway, sorry to interrupt. It's just, you know, you're talking about my world, so I got to go, you know, a little bit in there.
It's all good. Multinational cast. So, once you got back to New York, what happened next? Did you start? Did you know that you were going to be writing comics? I mean, has this career path always been on target for you, or like you had said before, was there twists and turns along the way?
I fell into writing comics kind of ass backwards. I was an actor for many years, and that was my thing. Like I was always. It's weird to say that was my fallback, because there's no such thing as a fallback in the arts. You know, like it's just all struggle, and you know, you have to go up against your friends sometimes and stuff. But acting was something I was confident in, and I still think I can do it. And I still think, you know, like if I were to pick out a career for my longevity and stuff, like that would be it. But I would go on auditions. I wouldn't get very many roles or anything. And I just said, screw it. I'm going to start writing my own stuff. So I started writing scripts and never finishing them. But I had posted on AOL around about 95, 96 or so. If anybody needed a script doctor, you know, like I would be happy to help them with their scripts. And I got two guys that contacted me, and they were both comic book guys. I don't know where they are now or what they're doing, but that was kind of how I cut my teeth. Like I found this, I don't know that it was a lecture or if it was just kind of like a syllabus kind of thing that Kurt Busiek had done. And I mean, I loved Astro City, still do, and I figure, all right, Kurt's the guy, you know. If it's not going to be Kurt, it might be Mark Waid, but those are the two guys that I would, you know, if I were going to write comics, those are the two guys I would emulate. So I found something that he had written. If you just search Kurt Busiek, AD, Ad Astra, you'll find this thing. And I basically just stole everything from it. You know, like, I learned, but I didn't, you know, steal anything. But because, you know, it was all there. And this was like, again, 96, very early AOL days. You know, like the internet is just what we're seeing then as opposed to now. Like the information that's out there today is just, there are so many different writing sites now that, you know, a lot of the new writers are very lucky. But that was the only thing I could find. So I just pretty much took what I learned from that over a weekend or so and applied it to what these guys had written. And then I also, you know, thinking in strip doctoring terms, you know, as an editor, basically, I would see what was wrong with their stories. And I mean, if I were to look back now at the writer that I am today as opposed to the writer I was then, I was full of crap. You know, like, I didn't know what I was talking about. But I had a pretty good sense of story at that point, and I just did my best to kind of say, okay, this is what works and this is what doesn't work. And they go, okay, can you write it for me? Or would you be interested in writing this title? And I just, you know, I never thought about money, you know, or getting paid to do it. So I just thought, all right, yeah, sure, I'll try it. So I just, you know, I developed a couple of things on my own. And one of the things that I had been developing at that point was a cable access TV show that would be done in the way of the old Hollywood serials, you know, from the 30s and 40s. So I wanted to do a comic that was kind of in that realm, in that world, and that was a comic that I did called The Mercury Chronicles, which, no, you never saw it because it never came out, but there was a Speakeasy Comics had done a Zero issue, which if you look on eBay, you might be able to find. I don't know, probably not worth much, seeing as how it was a Zero issue. But yeah, it was, you know, that was a book that I was trying to develop for a long time, you know, since 96, and people are always asking me at shows, do you plan on doing it? And I don't know, like, it's kind of like breaking up with a girlfriend, and you try to get back together with her and stuff, and then at some point you realize, well, it's just time to move on with my life, and that was kind of what Stray was. Stray was just me. All my books tie into each other, all of them, whether they're World War Mob, FCHS, whatever, you know, anything that's creator-owned, they all, you know, kind of fit with each other in a certain long-winded explanation that I could give you, but it really shouldn't affect how you enjoy them. So Mercury Chronicles does kind of appear in Stray, but not in the sense of what you've seen so far. You'll see it more later on, you know, but it is there. Just because I don't believe in wasting an idea, you know, especially if it's a good idea.
And
I can't remember if I answered your question now.
Yeah, you did. You did. And we actually saw a little bit of that. We had talked to you once before, and you had pointed us to some public domain artwork you had done with Sean Isaacs, mm-hmm. Where you were taking that very cool character concept and bringing it more modern. Can you tell us how you first encountered Sean and how that working relationship came to be?
I think it goes to Project Rooftop, which was started off by two of my friends, Dean Tripp and Chris Arendt. They had done a really, before the word meme was even a thing, they had created this Batgirl meme where everybody kind of reinterpreted Batgirl. And I was a part of it. I actually drew a Batgirl that's somewhere on the internet. My friend Jamie Gailey also, I think, was the progenitor of it. And it's just that Dean and Chris had kind of focused it a little bit and, you know, kind of gave it a forum on their site that they created that weekend. As everybody's still submitting Batgirls, they just created a site that, you know, would be that. I think it was on LiveJournal first. So they kind of just aggregated it, you know. Then they decided to launch their own site, and they would ask me to kind of judge, just because I'm a friend, and, you know, I'm a writer, I guess. They asked me to judge a few things, and then they decided they were going to, you know, kick it up a notch, and they kind of made me kind of an editor of a sort on the site. And they were like, "Do you have any ideas for columns?" And I had come up with this idea called Retrofix, which is basically taking a public domain character and reinterpreting it as if it were created today. So somewhere, you know, at that point, I guess I, you know, more so than making comics, I got interested in finding artists and putting together, you know, the right artist for the right retrofix. And I was on DeviantArt. I was looking at different things that would come up in the Project Rooftop kind of feed, you know, with, you know, typical artists that, you know, like Ming Doyle, people that are huge now, Robbie Rodriguez, Jamie McKelvey, like these are guys that, like, we would look at their art on DeviantArt, and then on the side they would say more art from this artist, and then underneath it, art like this. And somewhere along the line I saw a design that Sean did for Charlie for WatchGuard, and this is probably at this point 3, maybe 4 years now ago, and I was already working on Stray with a different artist, and Sean just saw the one or two. If you look on DeviantArt, I have like 4 or 5 pieces of art that are up there that are either things that I've lettered or things that I've created, or co-created, I should say, that another artist has interpreted or whatever. And Sean had seen some Stray art on there, and he's like, "Wow, this is really cool." Years later, I find out Sean had been trying to figure out a way to do a dog-themed superhero that didn't seem like a joke. And I guess it just worked out from there. And our relationship really just started with, "I like Aquaman. I like Aquaman too. I like Nightwing. Oh, I really like Nightwing. Hey, you know, how much would it get you to, you know, to just do this commission for me, you know, like digitally and everything? It costs this much." Okay, and so we just go back and forth, and I go, "Here's the article I'm working on," et cetera, et cetera. And we just got along. I mean, we both had very similar likes and dislikes. We would talk on Skype, and we still do. You know, we would talk on Skype about comics that we've read or movies that we've seen or, you know, whatever. And we're only about 6 years apart in age, and there was so much that we had in common that it was ridiculous. Come to find out that doing Stray, we both lost our fathers. You know, and it was it's ridiculous how much he and I are alike in a lot of ways. So he was originally going to do the second volume of Stray to give the other artist a break. But when that other artist just couldn't, like, it took him 2 to 3 years to finish the first issue. Yeah. I don't know if, you know, if people are going to be able to see this or listen to this, but Walt just gave me like a what? Like kind of looking.
Yeah, I keep my microphone muted while everybody else is talking.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what?
And so I just said, look, I know that there's no money, and I couldn't pay you to do this, and, you know, this was all, you know, in hopes of doing a Kickstarter or getting a pitch out there or whatever. But I had to, I don't want to say I had to fire him, but I had to part ways with the other artist. And so that night, after I parted ways with him, I said to Sean, I emailed him, and I said, look, if you want to do Stray, it's yours. And he's like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah. The only problem is you have to redesign everything, which sucks. Because we had all this preliminary work done and all these designs that were just, they were great. You know, like the other artist is fantastic. I wish I could work with him. It just didn't work out. And Sean just, you know, he's like, all right, let's just start, you know, like from the beginning. And I think the best part about that is it made the book Sean's. You know, instead of like taking someone else's ideas and going, I mean, because I could have easily paid $100 for the Stray design, let's say, like for the initial Stray design. But, you know, not doing that, and again, a great design, not doing that made it so that Sean was emotionally and maybe not financially per se, but like he was invested in the book, you know. And if you're going to be a co-creator, you know, and you're going to work with somebody and they own it 50%, you might as well give them, you know, 50% of the work as well. You know, like you might as well say, okay, let's make this as much yours as it is mine. You know, that's pretty much what we did.
And how's it been? How's it been with sharing those duties? Because unlike a comic book universe where you have one direct vision, you basically have two imaginations filling into that, and you know, bringing flavor. How's that collaboration been?
I can't answer that for Sean. I've never heard a complaint, so that must be good. But for me, you know, if I were so concerned about being the 100% owner of the thing, I would have written a book. When you go into comics, you know that that's exactly what the nature of collaboration is in that respect. It is art and literature. It is cinema in a lot of ways. It is a book in some ways. But everything that all the things that it is, it also isn't any of those things. And it really has to be a marriage of two people, even three when you consider the colorist. I letter the book, so I also feel like I have an artistic stake in it, in a sense, you know, where I feel like I want to make sure that my letters complement his art, you know, so that way, you know, like when you're looking at it, you're not distracted by the letters, but they all work in concert with each other. And the same thing, Sean is very hands-on with the colors, and Ross and, you know, Simon also colored the first issue. But Ross and Simon were hand-picked by Sean for a reason. So I feel like when you do get into it, the one thing I hated about doing comics before this book was I wrote the book and then I handed it off. And then I was just the editor. Where are the pages? Where are the pages? Where are the pages? But becoming a letterer added another dimension to what I brought to the book and just said, okay, I need those pages to letter. So give me the inks when they're done and I'll letter the inks. And then once the colors come in, we can just, boop, they go right on top. You know, like, so it has become a lot better learning that skill to make comics for me. So I do feel like I don't feel like I do more than my share. You know, like I don't feel like, since I'm writing, lettering, and ostensibly editing, I don't feel like I'm doing more than Sean, who's penciling or inking, and even art directing at the same time. I feel like we're all just working, you know, really well.
That's groovy. The whole lettering thing, you hear a lot of guys, you know, they always reference their letters, but it's not everybody that gets in and jumps into that particular skill. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what drove you to get into lettering and how you learn the skill and where can other people find how to do this? Because there's a lot of interest in it, especially with creator-owned comics starting to be more popular?
There's a writer by the name of Tony Lee, who's based out of England. Really good friend of mine. We've been friends for, it's got to be like 13 years now or something. And Tony was the one who said, you should start lettering your own work. And I really wasn't sure why he recommended that to me, you know, and I wasn't really... I was roommates with Jeff Powell, who was the letterer of Atomic Robo. So Jeff and I have always been really good friends, you know, like we live together, we work together and stuff. And so I always figured, well, I'll just get Jeff to letter it. And what happened was, at some point I realized, if I'm going to make a comic, it's going to cost a lot of money. And I'm not going to see any of it. So where can I cut... yeah, Andrew's nodding his head. Where can I cut costs? And it's not that I thought that I was good enough to letter a book for free, because, I mean, you've seen guys letter, you know, like their own books, and they look like they lettered their own books. But I wanted to be able to take whatever money I would spend on lettering and either invest it in myself or learn how to do it for free somehow and just not spend that money. So what I did was I contacted Andy Schmidt from Comics Experience, and I took their lettering course. And it was taught by Dave Sharp, who... I can't remember what I just read. He was lettering something for one of the DC Convergence books. But he's done work for Marvel. He went to the Cuber School. He, like, you know, perfectly suited to teach a class. And I took that class, and it was the best $500 I ever spent in my life. Seriously. Like, I can't recommend them enough, number one, for the professionalism of the guys teaching it, but also for what I got out of it. If I were to have spent money on a letter or everything that I've lettered so far, that I mean for myself, not even, you know, freelance lettering that I've, you know, lettered for other people and gotten paid for. But if I were to take all that money, it would have been at least $1,000. So I made my money back, you know, or I saved the, you know, twice the amount of money I would have spent, you know. So I it's just an added dimension. You know, as a writer, you're constantly questioning what you're putting on the page, is it too much, is it too little? And then you sit there and you start ballooning out the words and stuff, and you go, oh, I am really verbose there. I'm gonna take that out, replace those two words with one that do, you know, and you self-edit on the fly. And it's an invaluable skill, you know. And also, you know, I'll letter the pages and I'll send them to Sean and I go, what do you think of the placement? And again, we're working together to make this book look good. So he'll say, well, why don't you move this just a hair to the right, or let's move this move this one to the next page. Again, art directing. So again, I feel like more of a part of the process. I feel like I am an artist in a sense, you know, even though I'm not penciling or inking. I feel, you know, and lettering is definitely an art, because you can, there is a way to do it wrong. Like, there is definitely a way to do it wrong. And I've seen, there is a, what's that movie called? Twilight. There's a Twilight manga. If you ever want to see lettering done wrong, seek out that manga. The first one. I don't know about the second or third one, but I know the first one is absolutely terrible. They use Times New Roman as a font, which, you know, if they would have used Comic Sans, at least they were trying, but they use Times New Roman. They use, like, the balloons are just way too big for the words. It's just awful. So, you know, there is a way to letter wrong, so it definitely is an art, you know?
Do you actively seek out lettering jobs now, or is it just your own stuff that you like to scribble?
I prefer not to. I had done a lettering gig for a friend of mine, and it almost destroyed our friendship. It might have, but I still consider the guy a friend of mine, so he might think that I'm an ass, and he doesn't talk to me anymore or whatever. But, you know, I just... Money's a weird thing. Money can definitely destroy friendships as much as, you know, cheating on someone's wife or whatever, you know. Like, it's really... It can hurt. So I tend to not seek out lettering gigs anymore. What I do now is, when I seek out writing gigs, I go, well, I'll letter it for free. You know, if you want to pay me to write it, you know, I'll letter it for free. Just because, again, it's just a fun thing for me at this point. It's artistic expression, in a sense. But I prefer to letter my own stuff, just because I am making changes on the script, and you shouldn't do that to somebody. Like, it's funny, I did this gig for, what's their names? Advent Comics. And I wrote a story for them, and I go, I'll letter it, you know, for like 10 bucks a page or whatever. It's only like 8 pages, so I mean, it's not even 100 bucks. And so they sent me the pages, and I'm sitting there and I'm lettering, and I look at the art and I go, wait a minute, there's something missing. The artist changes the art. And I couldn't figure out how to salvage the lettering for it. So I contacted the publisher. I said, are you aware of this? He said, no, I'm not aware. I said, well, you know, for your future reference, if your artist ever changes any of the script that's in the art, you have to let the writer know, number one. And number two, you fire him on the spot, because that's not his job. So I lettered it, and I took my name off the credits for the writing, because it just, it reads like hell. It doesn't read well. And I'm not going to get blamed as the writer that the story doesn't read well because someone else changed my script. So, I mean, I'm still credited as the letterer, but yeah, I you feel very strongly about these things. It's not only that I put work into it or anything like that. It's just that, you know, my goal isn't to make myself the best writer or the best creator or the best anything. My goal is to literally make comics better and make better comics at the same time. Like, that's, I like, you can sit and talk to Ray Anthony Hike, Charlie McKelvey, anybody that you guys know that I know, that is my mantra. Make comics better, make better comics. Like, that's, do I know what I'm doing half the time? Not really, but I mean, I can fake it pretty well. And, you know, maybe turn out something really, you know, really worth reading. So.
Now, we've heard before you talk about the personal issues in your life that contributed to some of the story of Stray. Mm-hmm. But is making better comics one of the things that drove you to write the story in the first place?
No. Stray was an entirely different animal, pardon the pun, when I started. It was supposed to be kind of a Silver Age comic homage with the humor of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So it was like, it was supposed to be a comic about nothing. You know, a sidekick has now been given the keys to the kingdom, in a sense. So you have the mentor retiring, marrying, or he's already been married to one of his rogues gallery, you know, like she hates the sidekick. She's always hated the sidekick. She always kind of wants to see him dead. And it was very much like Larry David, Jeff Garlin, and Susie Essman on Curb Your Enthusiasm. They're dynamic. And it was only because I wanted to do something kind of, not raunchy, but kind of funny and kind of crass and kind of out, you know, something that you don't see in a superhero comic. And I think, maybe subconsciously, maybe that is true. Maybe I was trying to make a better comic by doing something that I wasn't seeing out there. But what had happened was I saw The Dark Knight. I looked at Stray all over again, and I said, this is, or that other version of it. I said, that's what I want to do, but as like The Dark Knight. So I kind of started shifting focus and making it a more serious take. And then a weird thing happened. I had a friend of mine who is a rapper, like he's a hip-hop artist. He was like, I want to do a soundtrack for something. And I said, here's a script for all four issues. You know, read it, and maybe you can come up with a song. He came up with an entire soundtrack for it, but he's only recorded two as of yet. One is only a demo, and the other one was on the Kickstarter. So he had recorded it, and he sent it to me, and I downloaded it onto my iPod. My wife and I were driving somewhere, and we were listening to it as we drove. And as we're coming up to the toll plaza, I remember this clear as day, we're coming up to pay the toll, and she says, he's singing about you. I said, what are you talking about? She goes, listen to it. He's talking about you and your father. And so I listened to it again, and I just started thinking, all right, let's just take away all the superhero stuff and just listen to it for what it is. And I listened to it, and I heard somebody, you know, pretty much reciting my life story. And when I heard it, I go, that's what I have to play up. He caught it, and it wasn't even, I didn't even intend it. So what if we played all those personal things up and really make it about me and my father and about the struggle to deal with his death and, you know, my, you know, somewhat battle with depression in some ways and, you know, drug use that I've been involved in and stuff. And I think it made for a better story. But again, I had to hear someone else tell me my story that I had already told them. Isn't that weird? Like, it just...
Yeah, it's a little weird. And in a sense, the Stray almost comes across, not really a cautionary tale, but how all of these life choices really contribute to who you start becoming. You
right.
know? I mean, because, I mean... All of us on the panel today, we're all guys that are either circling four decades or have four decades.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, we can remember back to the time when we were, you know, under 30, and anybody under 30 is an idiot. you know, I mean, and myself included. And you sit there and you look back on those years and you were like, what the hell was I doing? I was running around, hair on fire, in all different directions and no focus. And
right.
and those life choices actually inform not only who you are but and who you become, but how you deal with other people and how you can kind of mentor them.
Well,
so
it's funny because I always tell everybody that I'm not a big... I like Joseph Campbell, but I'm not entirely sure what he was, you know, talking about in The Hero's Journey. But I do understand a lot of it, and I'm trying to implement that into Stray overall. But I've never really put a lot of stock in plot and theme. And I realized, you know, by not doing that, I was doing it subconsciously, because Stray was always about redemption and about identity. And those are just themes I'm just very comfortable with, things that I grew up Catholic, you know, I that kind of thing. You know, it just seems that redemption and identity, well, redemption more so with the religion and identity, just because, you know, coming of age stories, they don't really ever say that they're about identity. Like, say 16 Candles, you know, Molly Ringwald's character isn't so much preoccupied with who she's about to become, but it's in there, you know, like it's really about her taking steps to being the woman she wants to be. And it's, you know, maybe it's being with Jake that's the first step in that. But, you know,
that's the thing, right? Like, you're talking about Joseph Campbell and The Hero's Journey.
Mm-hmm.
You put the nail right on the head there. I just spaced and Waters wrote, no. The director, the God damn it, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club.
Yeah, John Waters.
He was the one who did the modern version in the 80s of what the hero journey is for this Generation X and for who we are as a generation. The old hero journey doesn't account for us anymore. It doesn't take into anything we do. That world is the ancient world. It's gone. It's past. I think you've hit the nail right on the head there with 16 Candles. For me, it's always going to be Breakfast Club. These are stories that we can relate to much better in what our hero journey has been like, because they weren't, I guess, dependent or structured around the idea of these grand heroics, which is figuring out
sure.
who the hell you are. And opening up Breakfast Club with that quote from Changes exactly shows what you're talking about right now, about, you know, the children you spit upon as they try to change their world, blah, 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 blah. Stray, to me, has so much more of that than the classic heroic journey. It has that, the idea of this person who is just trying to figure out are we allowed to swear here, Walt? Who the hell he is. I'll censor myself, my sailor talk. And that's good, and that's what I like about your book. That's what I like about reading this character, is his heroic journey is not Spider-Man's heroic journey. It's
sure.
not Spider-Man's heroic journey. It's the heroic journey I went through, my friends went through, you went through. It's the realistic one. It's the one we can relate to, and that's what I like about it. So kudos to you on that, man.
You know, like, there's a one of the, you know, if you look at the circle of the hero's journey, one of the things is he has to go to hell, you know, like, and sometimes it's a literal hell, sometimes it's a figurative hell. There's a, like, hell sometimes can be your own devise, you know, like of your own devices and stuff. Sometimes hell is just making a bad decision, you know, like it's very loosely interpreted, but every hero has to go to hell to realize if he's a hero or not. And that is going to come in Stray. Like, in some ways it's going to be very visual and very literal, but in many ways it's very it's very kind of figurative and very open to interpretation. And by the way, John Hughes, who we were trying to think of.
John Waters
did Flamingo.
Yeah, exactly. And Roger Waters is from Pink Floyd. So there we go.
But you know, like, the idea of the hero's journey is... What I've told everybody was, you know, there's always going to be four story arcs, four volumes, whatever you want to call it. And the idea is that by the end of the fourth one, which may or may not be the fifth one at this point, because we came up with another story at some point while doing this first one that just makes sense to do. But, you know, by the end of that last one, you know, whatever it is, the entire status quo is going to change. We're making a very concerted effort to make Stray all ages, even though this first mini isn't really truly all ages. I think it is. I mean, I could give it to a 10-year-old and be fine with it. I mean, there's no swearing, there's no sex, there's implied drug use, there's violence, but I mean, what else do you see that on TV? They watch Avengers and play video games. I'm perfectly okay with it. But the idea is, this is my idea of what an all-ages comic book is. I've always thought that, and I think I might have even said it on the Banff podcast once, a superhero book is about fighting. An all-ages superhero book is about helping. And when we get to the next, volume of Stray, the next arc, you're going to see that Stray makes a concerted decision to not be concerned with outer space, let's say, or with supervillains. He wants to take a drug off the streets, a drug that almost ruined his life. And that, to me, speaks volumes. Like if you are more willing to help somebody than you are into, you know, fighting your archenemy, I feel like that lends itself to that the kind of all ages that I'm discussing is, we're, like I said, we're circling 40. That's the kind of thing that we can read and be okay with, you know, and understand. You know, it's almost like community building or something, or, you know, community support. And kids, you know, like, you know, it's community service is what I'm looking for, But, you know, and kids, you know, can get that too. I feel like, you know, they'll understand that as well. Plus, you get a really cool robotic dog. what's not to love?
Does he get the barbarian woman and the to go with it and make the Doctor Who fourth level complete?
No, I should really do that. I should play with that at least, you know. But like it's funny because the first, I don't mind saying this, I don't think it's really a spoiler to tell you the truth, but the first volume is about how does he deal with his father's death, and how does that affect who he's going to be when he grows up, you know, let's say. But the second volume is really about, now that you've made your decision, what does everybody else have to say about it? You know, who are you alienating? Who are you, who's going to support you? Who's going to be your friend after all this is said and done? And the thing with the dog is really, when you really start to think about it, the dog is the last piece of his father that he has. You know, like it's, because I lost my dad when I was 15. And my grandparents still had our dog, you know, so it was, you know, seeing that dog just kind of made it a little bit easier to deal with my dad's death. My dog now is a pit bull because of my father, and that's kind of what, you know, Stray, it's funny, you have the Doberman, you have the Rottweiler, and Stray is kind of this nondescript dog, but he's actually a pit bull, at least as far as the ears go. The design of his costume is based on one of Sean's dogs, who I think was a terrier of some kind, which fits too. But we both love dogs, and I think we both recognize what dogs are in our lives. And to me, like, my dog is basically just me holding on to my dad a little bit more, even though it's not the same dog. He looks exactly like him.
It's one of those things where the dog looks like the owner?
He probably does at this point. He definitely gained weight as I have, so.
You talked before about depression and dealing with some of those issues. Has writing these stories been therapeutic for you?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. I don't know how. I've definitely become more introspective. I mean, and I was always introspective. I was always in my own head. And I was, I mean, when you're a writer, you're always in your own head. But I was always kind of quiet and, you know, observing and just, I was always that way. But with doing this and putting my therapy out for everybody to read, maybe that's why I'm so interested in what people think of the book. Like, I'm always wondering why people aren't reviewing it more, where I know once issue of the trade paperback comes out, we'll probably get a bunch of reviews anyway. But, I'm always wondering why they're not reading it now, you know, like the critics and stuff and all those other folks. And, you know, sometimes you feel like it's an indictment of yourself, and that's, you know, that plays into my neuroses and my depression and stuff like that. But it is therapeutic. It is, anytime you tell a story that's personal, you know, whether it be an anecdote or something like this, I feel like you are opening yourself up to criticism, but you're really opening yourself up to find like-minded people. It's almost like going to AA. You know, like everybody that goes to Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic. So when you walk in, you're not necessarily alone, even though you're by yourself. And that's what comics are. You read them by yourself. There's no way you can read a comic at the same time as 300 other people. You know, it's a shared experience that you do on your own. So I got this, I don't want to call it a fan letter, but it was a message on Facebook that I posted on the Stray Facebook page. And it was basically this guy using the name Connor Kent, who is the second Superboy, the clone. But he had said that, you know, thank you for writing this book because it made me realize that my dad was a hero. And, you know, he also drove a 68 Mustang, even though he said 67. I'll let it slide. You know, all these different things. He's like, my dad loved dogs, you know. And it's like, you know, that's the guy that I wrote the book for. You know, like, that's the guy who, or girl, you know, whatever, you know, I don't know who that person is, just using a guy's name, but whoever that person is, if those were, even if I told him this, if you wrote me just to say you read the book and liked it, that's enough. You didn't have to go through your own personal history, but the fact that you did and you were brave enough to say these things that you said, to me, means more than we give it an A, you know, or 5 stars or whatever, you know, ranking system somebody else has. So,
because that's you making a personal connection through your story to somebody else.
Yeah, and it's that's where the shared experience comes from. You know, like we are relating on a very real level. You know, and I put myself out there in interviews so people can, you know, people read Stray and they go, okay, what's more about this guy that wrote this book, or, you know, the artist that wrote this book, that drew this book, and they see any of the, you know, major interviews that we've done. Or like Robot Six, or 13th Dimension, where I actually interviewed Sean. They'll see that these are, you know, these are real experiences that these two guys have, and somebody along the way will say, "Oh, those are the guy, you know, those are the guys that did that," and I understand what they went through. Look, I am, you know, I'm very affected by teen suicides, you know, like especially. Kids that are, you know, identifying with a gender and being told by their family that they shouldn't, or they there's something wrong with them. I don't identify with them in that respect, but I identify with the idea of not feeling comfortable in this world sometimes. You know, because when my dad died, I was suicidal. I was I didn't feel like there was a place for me in the world. And so I get that. You know, I get kids that think like that. You know, and I'm at some point, you know, I would never insult them enough to do a transgender character, because I don't understand. You know, like I don't I don't live in that world, so I'll never be able to write it accurately. But I always want to give them a space where if they read our book, they'll say, okay, I'm not alone, you know, somehow, you know, like, but it's something that I'm working towards.
Absolutely. And the I identified with the book a lot because suicide and depression are a big part of my experience with the military, as far as I became a suicide prevention counselor with the military. I also did some depression training for depression and how to recognize it in soldiers. So seeing a book like this that actually, you know, can bring those feelings out to the forefront is it's not only cool that you have it done in a comic book, but it's also very cool that it's in a medium that's getting so much popularity, so it might see wide circulation and, sure, and people might start talking about it more.
I don't know, you know, like, I don't know that it's so... It's very easily swept under the rug. You know, it's a comic book. You know, it's got superhero costumes, it's got superpowers and stuff. And it's, and you know, like, and I still state that, you know, even though some might not notice, it's a mystery as well. But if you really dig deep, and I don't even think you have to dig that deep, but if you dig deep into the source material, or not the source material, but the material that's there, really, you will see that stuff. You know, you like, here is somebody that is struggling. He gets through it pretty fast, but, you know, the repercussions are there. You know, they're always going to be there. That second issue, I think, where he's in the kennel, which is kind of the secret headquarters that he and his father created, and he sees his father's death kind of through a virtual reality simulation that was running, and he just sees it, and he just, you know, understands that. There's so many different ways you could interpret that scene. He sees it and he realizes his dad was murdered, like literally murdered and targeted. Then there's a part where you can look at it and go, he was murdered because he, like, his father was murdered because he wasn't there. And then there's a part that, you know, you can say, he realized, again, and it's all just evolution to the same thing, he realizes that not only was he not there for his father, but he was out partying and, you know, selling drugs and, you know, trying to get high and trying to forget his life. And his father is literally fighting for his life. And I think that, you know, it, again, like, there's that moment where he's got his head down on the counter, on the desk, and he's just like, okay, Dad, you win. You know, and that's when he kind of decides that this is... That's why he doesn't wear a costume throughout the entire thing until the end of the second issue. You know, like, you had to be on his side, and you had to feel his decision as being a real decision. And once he puts that costume on, you have to be excited as a reader and as somebody that's two issues in, you're now invested in this character's success or failure and his life, you know. So once he puts that costume on the last couple of pages, that should be like the, yeah, that's it. Now we're with this guy. And, like, you know, you feel his depression, and you feel his decisions and, like, his regrets and stuff. You kind of go along with it.
Now, is this kind of the passion that you have for this character, this story, and what you're trying to tell? Did this lead you to pursue a career with Action Lab?
No, that was happy accidents. You know, like, if I could print it on my own and, you know, put out 4 issues by myself monthly and get a wide audience to see it, I would. But there's no guarantees that anybody's going to see it. There's no guarantees that anybody's seeing it now. Like our orders are pretty low. So, I mean, it has nothing to do with readers. It's all retailers, you know. Retailers are afraid to commit to something new, especially when it comes to superheroes. And, you know, they've had, at this point, 25 years of image, you know, so I don't fault them for that, but at the same time, you know, here's a weird thing I was thinking about today. I didn't reinvent the wheel. It's a superhero comic. It's not a new take on an old favorite. It's exactly, people that like the book are like, this is like an 80s comic, this is like a 90s comic, this is like a 70s comic. And I'm like, okay, it's all those things, you know, because that's where I grew up, I guess, and that's my influences on my sleeve. But I don't know that I've ever read a comic that dealt with death like this and dealt with identity issues and stuff, you know, like this. You know, so maybe that's the novelty of it. That's where it's kind of different. But again, you know,
it's good. Good. It's good.
Maybe.
No, stop. Listen, I've been reading a lot of indie comics in the past couple of years, and I've been reading a lot of Image stuff, too, that they've produced, and I've looked at a lot of Marvel stuff that's been produced, and even DC. And you're not only telling a good story. Sean's art is amazing.
Sure.
The lettering is great. The colors look good. So it is literally, on all four levels I will judge a comic, good. I have seen stuff that has been heralded by indie people about superhero comics, and the art is amateurish, the colors are bland, the story is pedantic and pedestrian. So the fact that you're saying about how the retailers aren't willing to take a chance, it's because they've been burned so many times on indie stuff or non-brand name superhero stuff. They're not giving the good stuff a chance because they don't recognize it anymore, because they don't see it anymore, because they don't want to look.
It's not me being humble. You know, it's not me saying that maybe it's good because it's, you know, because it's me. It's me saying that, you know, I tell everybody, I'll take the Pepsi challenge. You put Stray up against any Marvel and DC book, it's either better or as good as any of those.
Agreed.
And then I don't know, I'm not going to name names or anything like that, but you know, you can easily do it. It's not, that's not really what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that if there's a retailer that understood what this book was doing, they might be more inclined to kind of support it. But at the same time, you know, it is what it is. It's a superhero comic, you know. And,
yeah.
You know, you can't, you can, how's that line go in Fight Club? Putting feathers on a duck doesn't make you a chicken. Putting feathers up your butt doesn't make you a chicken. That's what it is. So, so, you know, it does look exactly what it looks like, you know, and whatever it is inside, you know, maybe they just need to penetrate it a little bit and to really understand. But, you know, I'm also not here to hold anybody's hand, you know.
Look, but it has a pedigree, my friend. Your book, you're doing what I do, which is whenever someone tries to compliment my work or my acting, you do the same thing I do, just go, because it's you're right. It's the way we're supposed to behave. Because if we start going, oh yeah, I know it's great, people then think and we're idiots and arrogant. Your book is good.
No, I know.
Great is good.
I mean, I know. It's as good as anything out there. I know that. But you know that the it's very hard to sell a book like this to the modern. Direct market is about 30 years old, give or take.
Yep.
I'd say the 80s or so. So it's hard to sell them on something like this because they've seen Caliber, they've seen Tundra, they've seen Image, they've seen Speakeasy, they've seen
Come and Go.
Yeah, you know, it's hard, you know. But you know what? The best part is I didn't, you know, Action Lab was just kind of a thing that happened. You know, I had a different publisher. And they just kind of, they backed out kind of, you know, right as we were getting ready. And Action Lab stepped up and they were like, we will support this book as long as, you know, you give us a book to support. And that's, to me, that's like, all right, good. You know, I'll give you as many books as you can handle.
And you've taken a position with Action Lab now. What are you doing with them now?
I'm their associate director of marketing, which doesn't mean anything. It just basically means that I'm helping them all angle out. You know, like whenever he needs help with writing a press release, I'll write one. More or less, I'm a creator liaison. You know, like so, if a creator needs to know, like if they want to set up a signing, I'll help them set that up because that's what I used to do at my old retail job. So you know, it's really simple and basic. It's not anything that like I don't know. Like I look over. I sometimes get an ad. For like an in-house ad and stuff, and I'm like, all right, that looks good. I don't know what an in-house ad is supposed to look like. I actually, funny enough, Charlie McKelvey was putting WatchGuard Zero to print a couple days ago or something. Or he was getting files together. And he had asked me for an ad for the book, for Stray. And then he had asked Ray Height for an ad. And I said, why don't we just use the art that we did at Long Beach Comic Con, which has both characters on there, and just, you know, make it a dual ad. And so Ray was behind it, Charlie was behind it, and no one would design it. And I don't know how to design an ad, man. I'm just like, all right, I'm just going to put a logo here, a logo there, and write some copy and put the Atchalab logo and make sure our like copyright information is there and stuff. But I really don't know what the hell I'm doing. So we kind of, like, it was a week had gone by, and no one had done anything. And I said, all right, I guess it's me. So I just put it together, and I sent it to them, and we just kept going back and forth until we had the ad that, you know, Charlie wanted. It wasn't easy, man. And I know what my strengths are. My strengths have nothing to do with making ads and stuff. I can definitely make sure that the right creator is at the right signing on the right day, but yeah, other than that, like, I really am just learning on the job, really.
Yeah, but that's good. That brings some freshness to the position that someone who's gone through the whole educational indoctrination of advertising wouldn't have. So you may strike on gold. You may create something.
Well, you know, I know that it's funny because when I took the job, I had said to them that I know that my future in this industry is not going to be as a creator. It's going to be as an editor, which is, to an extent, being a creator still. But I know that it's going to be as an editor, and that's because I know how to network, I know how to get the right teams together, I know how to do all that stuff. And I figured doing this was a very good way to see how the corporate structures run, you know, to see how the ships run on time and all that stuff. So, again, it's all learning on the job. It's fun so far. I don't hate it. You know, which, who can say that about any job, really? You know, after a couple of months, you grow to get despondent about it, or, you know, you're just, you know, ambivalent. But, yeah, it's a good time, you know. And, again, Jamal and I have been friends for a long time. I really just look at it as I'm helping a friend of mine out.
Now, what do you have coming next? Right now we have Stray, and we've seen plenty of previews of art and some writing sample stuff that we've seen going on. You got issue 4 dropping when?
It should be, what's today, May? No, it's not May, it's April. Should be at the end of April, possibly beginning of May. It's running a little late because we had a little bit of a delay in January. As far as, like, everything, we had sent the issue to the printers around, like, issue 1 was supposed to come out in January, ended up coming out in February. And I think what happened was we had sent the files to the printer right at the same week as the holidays, so everything just slowed down and just kind of had to deal with it. So it should be end of May, maybe beginning of June, and then the trade would be about a month after that, like, say, end of June, beginning of July. We I think they announced it at WonderCon, so I'm not speaking out of school, but there will be a Stray, Midnight Tiger, Molly Danger one-shot that comes out in November, which will be done by Jamal, Ray, Sean, and I, and probably Ross is going to do the colors. So that'll be fun. It was weird. Like, I did San Diego last year, and we announced Stray at San Diego, and while I was announcing, speaking about Stray, I had said, and just so you know, and again, this was something that had been planned before I was at Action Lab. This was something that Ray and I had always planned. So it's just so you know, Stray and Midnight Tiger are in the same universe. Jamal Igel, like, was sitting at the dais, or whatever you want to call it, the panel, and he turned to me and he goes, so is Molly Danger. So it's like, all right, well, we're going to make that happen for real. So we put together a one-shot. The one-shot leads into another series that'll be end of December, maybe middle of December, that we're doing. That's going to be a very big deal. The less said, the better, because I don't want to ruin anybody's expectations. But after that series comes out, will be the next Stray miniseries. There might be, like, one Stray one shot, which is funny when you say stray, but there might be a stray one shot before the next mini. But yeah, so there's going to be plenty of stray material out there, sporadically and, you know, planned, you know, ahead of time. There's going to be a stray Midnight Tiger one shot that has to happen before the next stray mini, because of all the things that we have planned in that stray, the next stray mini. There has to be like this kind of, it's a very fun story, really silly one shot where Stray and Midnight Tiger go on a road trip. So it's like a buddy cop film. But as of right now, Stray and Midnight Tiger don't know who each other are. They're really, you know, but they will become really good friends. You just have to see how it happens first. So that's what the Stray, Midnight Tiger, Molly one shot is going to be. It's going to be basically, you find out that Midnight Tiger and Stray don't really get along. Molly Danger and Stray have kind of a history. Midnight Tiger is a big fan of Molly Danger. It's a lot of fun. It's really a lot of fun. And there's a lot of other interconnections between them, too, that happen in the past that they don't even know about. So.
And you said that's coming along in December?
The Stray Midnight Tiger Molly will be in November, right before the holidays.
And, of course, coming from Action Lab. So when you get some solicit information, so we can pass that on to the store owners, shoot that our way, and we'll spread it far and wide.
That will probably be, we're going to announce that and the other thing at the Retailer Summit in Baltimore in September. So, you know, hopefully, you know, all the promo material, all the artwork and stuff, you know, we'll be able to, you know, show everybody everything, you know, in September. But it should be solicited, the one shot should be solicited in September anyway. Like, so you'll know September 1st, you know, first week of September when previews comes out exactly what's going on and stuff.
Rock and roll. And if people want to stalk you on the internet, where's the best place to find you?
Stalk me or follow? Yeah, I mean, that's kind of
if you need new best friends on Facebook, where should they find you?
You know, here's the thing: if you want to find me, just, you know, do a Google search for Incogvito, Incogvito. You'll find Tumblr. You'll find Facebook. You'll find Twitter. You'll find Instagram. You'll find it's basically my brand name, I guess. You know, like. But yeah, there are other things coming too, as far as like projects. So there's a lot of stuff that people should, you know. I think one is going to be very unlike anything I've ever written, or lettered at that point. But I think, you know, it's something that people don't expect from a guy who wrote a comic book about a superhero, you know, or even World War Mob. World War Mob is not done yet. You know, we're I can't really talk too much about it because there is pending legal stuff, but we're trying to finish it as well. Hopefully by the end of this year, maybe even beginning of next year, we'll put out a trade of the whole thing. But yeah, it is a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff.
Anything you'd care to break here, or are you keeping stuff close to the vest for the moment?
Anything I care to break. Other than the Stray Midnight Tiger Molly and stuff. I'll tell you this one, because it's still still in development. A lot of people have wanted to see the kind of the teenage years of Stray. Like, they wanted to see the Rottweiler. Like, I keep getting messages like, wow, I would kill to see a Rottweiler miniseries or something like that. There is an artist. There is a possibility that next year you will see maybe a 4-issue limited series that takes place in that time period. But funny enough, speaking of the military, he's in the National Guard. So the artist, his name is Lee Gaston, and he's a fantastic artist. If you find him, you know, look him up. He's an amazing, amazing, amazing artist. Different look altogether from what Sean does. Like, he's just not. It's a different feel, so I kind of want to do something different. And that was a thing I proposed to him. I said, look, if you're into it, maybe we can do this as, you know. And he's like, well, I can't do it on a regular schedule kind of thing. You know, it'd have to be kind of on my schedule and stuff. And I'm like, that's fine. You know, I'll put it out when it's ready. I'm not in any hurry. You know, my other story, Prisoner of None, which is at prisoneronone.com, works like that too. David Bednarski, who's the artist, he is literally a scientist by day. And we made this arrangement. We don't put anything out until it's ready. You know, like, because you have a full-time job, I just do this. You know, like, so my schedule is always open. But because you have a full-time job and, you know, you are, you know, working, you draw when you draw. You know, you give me the pages when you have them, you know, and we'll put it out when it's all done. You know, I'll put it all up at once, you know, and sell the PDF or something, or, you know, do a page at a time on the website. But, yeah, so I don't mind doing those arrangements with guys, because if you're going to get the quality that you expect to get, then at least you're getting that high quality that you really want, you know. But that's what's funny is the Rottweiler teen year thing might not necessarily come out from Action Lab at first. It might be self-published and then come out from Action Lab. I don't know yet. It's just really a matter of when we get it done and how we want to present it so that, you know, we both get a little bit of money out of it, especially Lee, because he'll definitely deserve it. And which is tough, too, because he doesn't own these characters. You know, like, it's totally, you know, mine and Sean's characters, so what financial stake does he have in it unless he's getting paid to do it? So it's very, we're still working that out, but he's definitely interested. You know, the story's already there. It should be a lot of fun.
Right on. Now, before we call it a night, is there anything that both of our esteemed guests would like to pitch before we slip out the back door?
Pitch?
what do you have coming?
I just got 21 of inks on Heroic 2 and pencils for the last page as well. So we're about a month away from Heroic 2 probably being done and ready to show everybody. Beyond that, I can't think of anything else to pitch. So over to you, Vito.
Oh, I did all my pitching. I'm done.
I'm going to pitch a fit. That's what I'm going to do. There we go.
There you go.
I mean, all right. You know, if you like the Daredevil series on Netflix, we're doing kind of a spoiler-heavy episode of my podcast, The Untitled Opinion, which is on theuntitledopinion.tumblr.com. There's also a Facebook page, so facebook.com/theuntitledopinion. So we're going to talk about that this week. That's pretty much it. I mean,
I love that show. That show is super cool. The one, my favorite so far has been the Justice League episode you guys did with Aquaman and Wonder Woman.
Yeah, that was fun. Like, you know, I think next week after we do this Daredevil episode, we're going to do the Hulk, and then we're going to go back to the Justice League idea where we do some of the other spin-offs that are coming as well. So, that's a fun show. You know, look, man, it's fun working with your friends, and that's really what it is. It's literally a conversation between me and Scott Falk, who's a really good friend of mine. We just sit there and we just talk about movies, talk about comics and stuff. It's just how we talk, you know. Like it's easy when you're doing it like that, you know.
Oh yeah, I like the script presentations too. You guys have a lot of great ideas. I mean, when people talk about stuff like, because I'm not a DC guy, mm-hmm. so like, you know, when people talk like Batman or whatever, the Batman I like the most is the one from the Arkham games.
Sure.
You know, because it just seems like I don't need to read every single Batman comic to see where the current story is. So, like, when you guys do your scripts, those are pretty tight because it's bringing a take on the character that I can actually get into from the ground floor. So it's a really great show.
Well, you know, it's like we said, you know, we'll never do the Stray story or the Phileas Reed or any of our own creator-owned stuff. And that's why we don't mind putting that stuff out there, because if someone's going to steal that idea, good. We want to see this stuff made. You know, the way it is, you know, I mean, sure, you know, there's a lot of, we, as creators, we always take a proprietary stance on the stuff that we make up, you know, like our imagination is our bread and butter. But for this, we just both agreed at some point that it's like, let's just see what happens if we just say it out loud. You know, what's the worst that could happen? Somebody will steal our idea, make a good movie? Oh, sorry. You know, like, oops. But yeah, like, we just, it's just two guys talking in a room about stuff they like. And I mean, that's just, it's just fun. Like every episode is fun. You know, even when I feel like I don't, Scott did a really good pitch for a Thin Man TV show, if you can look back. I think it was called Pilot Season, is the name of the episode. But The Thin Man as a TV show, where I just threw my hands up and said, son of a bitch, I really got to start working hard at these again. So yeah, it's a fun show. We enjoy doing it. We might be a little late this week because I think Scott's still not caught up on all of Daredevil, but that just gives me an opportunity to watch the last couple episodes again. So
what was your, just out of curiosity, what was your takeaway on Daredevil, if you could sum it up in one sentence?
They got it.
Yeah, bingo.
But, I mean, without, you know, like I said, like, we're going to talk about it and, you know, we're going to do spoiler-heavy stuff, but they got it. You know, like, it's just, I was always looking forward to the Jessica Jones alias Jessica Jones show that's coming, just because I enjoyed the series so much. And after seeing this, I'm really looking forward to it, because...
That's how I feel about Iron Fist.
See, I don't know what... Iron Fist can go a couple of different ways, as can Luke Cage, depending on how much of their origins they decide to focus on.
But they've earned trust with what they did with Daredevil.
Yeah, sure, you know, and, you know, no idea what the Defenders is going to be. No idea whatsoever. But...
You know, listen, I hated Daredevil. I never liked Daredevil. I was never a Daredevil fan, couldn't stand the character, didn't care to read them, no interest. Loved this show.
I mean, it's funny watching some of those fight scenes, especially in the last episode. I just thought, oh man, where was this show 2 years ago when I wrote the fourth issue of Stray, so I could actually tell Sean to watch this? Because yeah. You know, Billy Clubs, and Stray usually has his Bone Clubs. Yeah. So just like, oh, we could have stole so much in the show.
Walt.
Yes, sir.
Because you're a hand-to-hand guy, and you know me, bouncer, whatever, all that fun stuff. The one thing I loved, I was laughing my balls off, was I was watching or reading a review of the show, and some guy was praising the realism of the fights. And I'm watching going, dead, broken neck, not getting up, just watching these people get, like, pummeled, seriously, and then get up. And I'm like, there's this disconnect in Hollywood that I think that's happened where they think brutality is realism, and it's like, no, man, 30 seconds. A fight's over in 30 seconds at best. And, you know, it's not UFC, but I still liked it. Even then, I still liked it because it reminded me of, what's that movie, Old Boy. The fights in Old Boy had that same level of brutality, if not more, and I thought it was way more fun to watch that than watch the flippy, fly, wushu type stuff, which I'm just sick of at this point in my life.
Hey, nobody gets hit once. That was something I know. Everybody gets punched at least 4 or 5 times in the face, and then
yeah, it's the other extreme of unrealistic fighting. I love it. It's just brilliant. But yeah, that hallway fight, I'm telling you, that hallway fight in you can't remember what episode number it is, was just
episode 2.
Like, just wow. I just sat there going, this is insanity.
Yeah, it's brutal. You know, and during one of the episodes, a friend of mine from Afghanistan, he's stationed there now. Somehow he managed to get his hands on Netflix out there, and he was tweeting with me back and forth about it. And every time somebody hit a wall, he was like, concussion, broken ribs in the back, you're not getting up. it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But we're gonna put all of the links that we talked about today in the show notes once this posts, especially the Untitled Opinion. And once again, just to echo your comments on last week's episode, it's going to be spoiler heavy. So if you haven't seen Daredevil, just make sure that you
skip it.
Skip it until you watch.
Just listen to all the other ones, but skip Daredevil if you haven't seen it.
So I'm Walt, along with my partner Andrew, and today we were talking to Vito Del Sante. Vito, thanks again for coming out and for taking an hour and a couple to talk about your stuff.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's my voice I got to listen to over and over again.
Well, with that, we are out.